Dr. Anthony E. from San Fernando Valley.
Thank you. Thank you. My name's Anthony and I'm an addict. You know, I know that sometimes if you're new and people walk up to the podium and the first thing that they do is they thank the committee for asking them to come and share their experience, strength, and hope. I can't tell you why anybody else does that, but I do that because Narcotics Anonymous has blessed me to age here. And because I'm getting older, I get forgetful. So I always think of what's the thing I have to say first. So I want to sincerely thank the Central California Committee for asking me to come and share my experience, strength, and hope. There are times in our experience in this fellowship when people from across the country will ask you to come and share a message of recovery, but when somebody asks you that's, you know, 80 miles from where you live, that's a tremendous privilege. Because someone in that community actually knows who you really are. So, you know, it's not about the tape they listen to or the CD or the DVD or the reputation or any of that other stuff. Usually it's because somebody actually saw you doing whatever it was you're talking about in the meetings of Narcotics Anonymous. So thank you. Thank you. This is a tremendous honor. I try to do this as little as possible. And I'm going to tell you why. You know, I listened to Jimmy share last night. He mentioned it. I listened to Tony share this afternoon in the men's meeting a little bit about what our text says about the responsibility to carry this message and to repeatedly carry this message, and that responsibility never goes away. And I understand all of that. But I always believe that every time I stand here, someone else isn't, and that there has to be other people in this fellowship who have a message that needs to be heard, and that I'm taking that opportunity away from them. So I always feel like there was a better choice. I always feel like someone else could have done this. I always feel like someone else could have been given this opportunity. It's not because I disrespect the honor of it. It's because I just believe that in our fellowship, there are many people who have something that needs to be heard by others. So I have learned over the last several years, not only as a result of my own will, but I have to say the God of my understanding has put some restrictions in my life that I've had to live with that have made it a simpler process to respectfully decline the invitation to go share my experience, strength, and hope sometimes. And I have to say, I'm really okay with that. I got a letter from the committee and it said that my topic was basic recovery. So I got to share something about the nature of the addict that stands before you. I try to be as obedient as I can today. I try to follow direction to the best of my ability today. But I don't think about necessarily what it is that I'm going to say here, because then I'm saying it from my head and not from my heart. So I guarantee you, by the time I'm done, you will know what my basic recovery is about. You will know what I believe basic recovery is about. So I also need to say, in the event that I say something that is contrary to the advice that you get from people that you trust and have confidence in, or that you are sponsored by, please pay attention to what they tell you to do, because I don't want you calling me. Okay? Continue to call those that you have been calling before you ever heard from me. And the second thing is that if you don't hear anything from me that helps you to better understand the program of Narcotics Anonymous for yourself, know that this is going to help me. And so if you don't hear what you need, There are countless addicts in this room who will be more than happy to share with you what they believe about the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. Basic recovery is just such a great topic for this addict. Because I used to describe myself as a roaring 20s, old school dope fiend NA member. I have been here long enough to where, Jimmy touched on it last night. I'm from the Eastern United States. And when I walked into the rooms in Narcotics Anonymous for the first time, everybody in the room was a heroin addict. Most of them were convicts, both, or worse. So, the first thing that you have to learn when you're 25 years old, I think I was 26 actually, is that you walk in a room full of tough guys, gangsters, scoundrels, thieves, murderers, cutthroats, and you try to figure out how to sit there and be comfortable enough to hear a message and not be afraid that one of them cutthroats, murderers, or scoundrels was going to do something to you. Because I'd like to stand here and talk about how I was a gangster on the corner and, did all of this wonderful kind of, magnificent violence. And the truth is that I was a scared little boy from the very first moment I can remember and up to the very last moment I can remember standing out on the street corners. The scared little boy was always inside. And whatever mask I put on, whatever survival techniques I developed, none of that changed the fact that I spent every single day using in fear. In the absolute fear that, number one, they would find out that I was a scared little boy. Because on the corners I come from, demonstration of fear meant victim. And I was not trying to be victimized by anybody. So one of the things that I learned really early on in my life was how to become somebody I wasn't. How to pretend like I was something other than the reality of what was going on in my inside. We talk about the reason why we ended up where we did, and the truth is, man, I grew up in a single parent home. My mother loved me. My grandmother lived in the same house. My grandmother was a disciplinarian. She was 4'9". She had a cast iron skillet, and in those days, ironing cords used to be made out of cloth with wire strung in them. They were wire would be braided inside them. And she had an ironing cord with my name on it. And every time I got out of line, she had no problem letting me know who was in charge. That was just the reality of what happened with kids in those days. Today, if you did that, you'd be in the penitentiary. But getting hit upside the head with cast iron skillets, getting beat into the house with, switches and ironing cords and whatever else was within reach, common practice. So, they sent me to Catholic school. I was an altar boy in church. I used to play the organ in church on Sunday. I was going to be the first doctor, lawyer, judge, priest never came up. It was always one of them other things. It was usually something that had to do with what you saw on a television program called Ozzy and Harriet in those days, which was the depiction of the perfect family. White picket fence, three kids, a little dog. Dad was home. Dad worked every day. Mom cooked every day for the kids. The kids' clothes were ironed. It was that perfect, kind of vision that somebody had about what family was supposed to be. But when I walked in my house, usually my grandmother was yelling at me because it was something I didn't do in the morning before I left. If I was hungry, maybe there would be a piece of bologna and some Wonder Bread in the refrigerator. Maybe not. Maybe just Wonder Bread and mayonnaise. And I will tell you, Wonder Bread and Best Foods mayonnaise, in fact, Miracle Whip was the best. Okay? Because, the reality is that I'd love to say that life was great. Sometimes it was. Sometimes it wasn't. And you did the best you could with what you had. So I had to learn how to become resourceful. And to do that meant going out into them street corners and learning how to reach out, learning how to get what I thought I needed. So whenever the other kids in my neighborhood got brand new tennis shoes or, very few shiny bicycles, I got to say, usually it was about clothes. you know, every once in a while you would get the G.I. Joe with the Kung Fu Grip or the Little Army Man or something, you know. In those days, there used to be a television show called The Rifleman, and every kid in my block wanted this little fake rifle that you could jack the handle on, and it would automatically shoot caps. And I remember the first one I ever got, I took from a kid that was smaller than me. And then that kid's mother came over to my house, told my grandmother what I did. She slapped me upside my head with that cast iron skillet and gave it right back to him. You know what that lesson that taught me? Don't steal close to home. Not don't steal. Don't steal close to home. So, you know, we have an amazing ability to adapt. And I'm not talking about just addicts. I'm talking about human beings in general. Addicts have an even keener ability to adapt. Because for most of us, to stay alive, to stay out of the penitentiary, to stay out of police cars, to be able to use, meant you had to be successful at dishonesty and deception on a daily basis. Sometimes in a violent way, sometimes not. All my heroes, everything that I looked up to, everything that I respected, didn't come out of my house. It came out of the mouths of people standing on street corners named Big Mo, Larry, Jack, Two Guns. Never forget this one guy named Two Guns. He earned that because he always had two guns in his pockets. Always. But my heroes could knock people out with one punch. That's what I thought was, you know, I mean, I just thought that was it. If you could walk up to somebody and just knock them out cold, one punch, you were my hero. And in my neighborhood in those days, people fought with their fists. It wasn't that there wasn't guns, but tough guys were tough with their hands. And they would stand toe to toe with 50 or 60 people on each side and wait to see who was going to knock who out. And that would be the end of it. It'd be over. My, how things change. Because I was out there long enough to see not only my evolution as an addict, but the streets evolved around me as well. And the level of violence increased and the need to become more and more vicious, more and more ruthless. I got to the point where I stopped stealing. And I can't tell you when that happened, but I can tell you it did. I got to the point where I stopped caring about who I harmed. I can't tell you when that happened, but I can tell you that it did. I got to the place where the insanity of using felt normal. I never imagined that I would ever not want to use. Everybody that I knew was a dope fiend. Everybody. And the ones that weren't were punks. And let me tell you something. In my neighborhood, you would do anything. I mean anything. Not to be a punk. And I've done some scandalous, scandalous things in my life to avoid that label. I've caused a whole lot of harm in my life to avoid having myself referred to in that way. But the first time I stood up and talked from a podium in Narcotics Anonymous, I described myself as a punk, because I was, inside. You know, I've learned that talking about using, you know, I've heard many of us say we all know how to do that, but I'm going to give you one example of just how desperate we can be. I'm standing in a second floor apartment in a hotel, one of the worst neighborhoods of the city I grew up in, Washington, D.C. And I'm splitting drugs with one other person. The door comes off the hinges, and there used to be a squad of police officers that would go around with axe handles. They called them the warrant squad, and they would kick the doors in on shooting galleries and go serve warrants on people who had, you know, warrants for them, because usually they were in shooting galleries. And so rather than to run, I see an open window about 10 feet from me, and the guy that I was splitting the drugs with ran away. I stole all the drugs in one motion, leapt out a second floor window and didn't care what happened at the bottom. That's the nature of insanity. That's the true definition of insanity. But that's the reality of what happens to us. Now, everybody sitting in this room has their own reality of what using was for them. Everybody sitting in this room knows how desperate you became, if you got to be desperate, because one of the things that is also happening for us today is that because so many people are being exposed to NA at a much earlier point in addiction, some of us aren't as desperate as many of us were when we came here. I'm telling you, when I got here, there was no other choice. When I got here, there was no alternative. It wasn't any doubt that I had another one in me. There was no doubt that I didn't need to be here. There was no question that I had reached the end of my road. So when I ended up in the treatment center, I learned how to become obedient because, you know what? I was desperate. I couldn't continue to live. I couldn't continue to cause the harm I was causing. I couldn't continue to do what I was doing. And it looked like maybe I could find a different way in this thing called Narcotics Anonymous. And I'll tell you what flipped the script for me. I'm in a treatment center, and Narcotics Anonymous panels used to come in. People would come in, share their experience, strength, and hope. Now, I don't know about you, but I always had that one person when I was out there using that was my poster child for I ain't that bad yet. Okay? And that's who I would compare myself to every day. I would look at him, and I'd look at myself in the mirror, and no matter how I looked, I ain't that bad yet. Okay? And so I'm sitting in the treatment center. I'm taking your inventory every single time y'all come in. And, you know, somebody, I remember this person came in, lived in suburban Maryland. He was talking about wrecking his father's yacht, taking prescription medication, smoking marijuana. And I sat in the back of the room and I took this guy's inventory for about 25 minutes. Because, you know, I thought like, hey, man, I spilled more dope than this guy I've ever seen. So, you know, he's sitting there talking about, you know, recovery and finding God. I mean, you know, the typical message that people try to bring to us. And I was incapable of hearing it. And then all of a sudden, there sits my poster child, for I ain't that bad yet. And he's clean shaven. He took a shower, cut his hair, had on a suit that didn't have blood stains all over the sleeves, briefcase. And he's sitting there talking about he found God. He got clean. He had been clean for 11 months, which I thought, come on, man, please. But I paid attention. It was the first time that I actually listened to what was being said. And what I recognized was is that I needed that example. I needed that visualization of someone that I knew had lived the life that I lived. Someone that I knew had come from the same places. We had slept on the floors of shooting galleries together. So it was no doubt this was a dope thing sitting in front of me. And when he started talking about this program called Narcotics Anonymous and a simple set of principles and the ability to change his life, I was captivated, man. Now, I thought that it was a con. I have to be honest. I thought that it was a gimmick, you know, some kind of newfangled pyramid scheme or, you know. And so after the meeting, I walked up to him and I asked him, I said, yo, what's the deal, man? And you know what? He didn't even try to explain. He just looked at me and said, no matter what, don't leave. And no matter what, don't get loaded. Keep coming back and one day you'll understand. So at that moment, that pissed me off. That motivated me. It did. It motivated me to want to keep coming back. It motivated me to want to uncover the secret, because there had to be a secret to this. No dope thing stops shooting dope on their own. There had to be something that they weren't saying. So I started to really pay attention. I started to perk up every time anybody walked in and started talking about this Narcotics Anonymous thing. And the thing I recognized was it didn't matter what color they were. It didn't matter where they came from. It didn't matter what their socioeconomic background was, what their religious beliefs were. It didn't matter whether they were gay or straight or loved to make love to animals or anything else. All of them said the exact same thing. That an addict, any addict, can stop using and find a new way to live in this program called Narcotics Anonymous. And that if I had the willingness, maybe I could too. Okay. So I really kind of like felt for the first time, man, maybe I got a chance here. Because I had tried all that other stuff. You know, the doctors and the priests and the uncles and the other relatives and the this and that. I tried all of that. This was the first time I actually had a glimmer that maybe, just maybe, this would work for me. And so I really started to dig in. I really started to pay attention. And, you know, as people kept coming, I kept hearing the same thing. Hope, faith, willingness. Hope, faith, willingness. Hope, faith, willingness. And, you know, I got to say, I talked about the fact that I went to Catholic school. So the word God for me, when I got to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, was a bad word. Because God meant punishment. God meant hell and brimstone and, you know, all of that other stuff that, you know, my entire childhood I had been told I was going to hell. So there was a point at which I thought, well, okay, I might as well earn my spot. But I came to realize that the God that these people were talking about had nothing to do with that God that I had familiarity with. It had nothing to do with those practices, with those places. It was about somebody finding a way to believe in something other than themselves that would allow them to let go and trust that something would have the ability to bring about a change in their life. And so I kept hearing you talk about a God of your understanding, my God, and I started to be able to actually separate the words from how you meant it. I started to be able to understand that you were talking about something that was inherently personal, had nothing to do with any book that I had ever read, had nothing to do with any experience I had ever had. And I started to try to work at believing in something. Because I got to tell you, I told you, I stopped feeling. And it took a long time for the feelings to come back. It took a long time for, as Jimmy talked about last night, for the spirit to be touched at all, much less awakened. You know, I'd love to say that I heard this miraculous message and bam, my spirit was awake. That ain't the truth. The truth is that there were nudges. There were things that I would hear in meetings. There were things that I would see you do. There were things that I would hear you say that would start to push at my reservations about being absolutely willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Because I started to see the evidence. And then I sat down one day with a guy who, I think he had 3.5 years clean, and I started to ask him about his relationship with a higher power. And he kind of took me back through the previous 2 years of my life. And he said, okay, if you have a problem believing in a higher power, let's do this. Think back over the last 2 years of your life. Pick a circumstance where you had an unexplainable intervention that either saved your life, prevented you from being incarcerated, kept you alive in some fashion. Doesn't matter when it was, where it was. And you know what? That was easy to do for me. Because there were a lot of those in my life. Bullets whizzing by my head, hitting the guy next to me, the police arresting the guy next to me, not me. Stopping the car in front of me, not my car. You know, I mean, I could start thinking of a whole lot of times when it should have been me, and it wasn't. And then he said, why did that happen? Why are you still here? How come you're not in jail? How come you're not dead? How come you're not paralyzed? Explain it to me. I said, well, I was lucky. He said, really? He said, okay, let's do it a different way. Your best friend is dead. Died from the same disease you suffer from, right? I said, right. He said, what made you different from him? What made you better at doing what you do than he did what he did? Why is he dead and why you're alive? And again, I said, because I was lucky. He said, okay, let's go to your very last day, your last day using. Explain to me what happened. So, you know, I've told this story countless times, you know, about a meal saving my life. And I used to attribute that to also being lucky. You know, it was lucky that I asked my wife to make me a pork chop dinner. that night. And that she got angry enough to make me sit there and eat it that night. And that because I sat there and ate it, I wasn't with all of the people that I would normally be with who got killed as soon as they got to where they were going. And I would have been in the middle of the back seat of that car that night. And then I started to see that there were plenty of times where something had intervened and kept me alive. Something had made it possible for me to get to that treatment center to hear that message that day. And I started to recognize that, you know what? Maybe there's something to this. Maybe that there is a power greater than myself that has been intervening in my life for as far back as I can remember that I've refused to accept or acknowledge. Maybe these guys are right. Maybe I do have a God of my understanding. I'm just unwilling to acknowledge him. And so I started to actively work at learning how to pray. And I'm not talking about the drop to your knees and, you know, oh God, get me out of this one, I'll never do it again kind of prayer that most of us are really familiar with. I'm talking about that honest recognition of, please help me to understand who you are and what it is you expect of me. And that took time. That wasn't easy. That's about practice. So one of the things about my basic recovery is, and I believe this to my core, there has to be a belief in a power greater than myself. There has to be. Because without that, I lack the capacity to move outside my own way. I refuse to see beyond what I can see. I refuse to accept what I can't believe. But with that, I can believe anything. I have the capacity to accept anything. I have the recognition to know that there's got to be some plan greater than anything I could devise. And so I started to work at this. One of the things we hear at every meeting, honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. With these, we're well on our way. So for me, because I kept hearing it every day, I started to try to be as honest as I possibly could. I started to try to be as willing as I possibly could. Now, I got to say, being honest, some of my willingness came from the fact that when I got clean, the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous for most people were about life and death. And what I mean by that is, I'm not talking about, you know, if you didn't walk into the room, you were going to drop dead out front. I mean that the people sitting in that room believed that the meeting was sacred. It was a sacred place. And that you respected it. And if you didn't respect it, they had no problem kicking your butt on the parking lot after that meeting was over. Okay? So I can't tell you how many times this 26-year-old punk got slapped upside the back of his head for talking in a meeting, because you didn't do that. Okay? For answering the phone or doing some other ridiculous nonsense, disrespecting the fact that there were people sitting there that night trying to save their life. They had no problem popping you in the back of your head and really didn't care whether you liked it or not. Now, I understand we've evolved. That ain't who we are no more, and that's okay. Because the rules of society have changed in 35 years. You know, you can't just walk around popping people in the back of their head no more. You know? But in those days, that's exactly what would happen. And people had no problem. I mean, you know, I used to think that I was a wannabe tough guy. There were some tough guys sitting in some of them rooms. And they had no problem sharing with you their experience, strength, and hope about being tough. Okay? Because they didn't allow anyone to disrespect the opportunity that a meeting for recovery represented. And they enforced it. They meant it. You didn't, you didn't throw trash in a parking lot. You didn't disrespect the meeting place in any way. Because if you did, you would be held accountable. And you know what? That's what this punk needed. Because I was stupid. Now I was 26 years old. I thought I was invincible. I never believed that, you know, the reality of, you know, dying of natural causes was ever going to be an issue for me. But you know what those guys helped me to do? They helped me to sit still long enough, to listen long enough, to hear what I needed to hear, to recognize that this program would work for me exactly the same way it worked for them if I had the ability to integrate a simple set of principles into my life. And I sat there long enough to do that. Now, you know, I'm going to meetings all the time. I'm being of service all the time. I'm doing everything everybody's suggesting. I'm trying to do my best to embrace the principles of the steps. But like, you know, if I asked Steve before I came up here, that banner looks like it was done on purpose, like a brick wall. That's actually not. That wasn't done on purpose. It just happened that way. But I can't tell you how appropriate that is. Because that's the reality of basic recovery. It's a set of building blocks. It's a set of blocks that we have to learn how to take one at a time and put together to build our own wall to create a program of recovery that works for us. And you start at the bottom. Imagine what would happen if you took all of those bricks out of the bottom of that wall. The wall would collapse. So I always heard, you know, that I used to think that recovery equals things. You know, when I had 2 years clean, I'm watching you guys walk into meetings. Some of you guys got on diamond rings and fancy suits, and you're driving new cars. You got your little new jobs. You know, everybody's like looking sharp, beautiful women. So I'm thinking, oh, there's recovery, right? That's what recovery's about. Recovery's about that bright, shiny stuff. And then I'm sitting in a meeting. I heard somebody say, you know what? You can dress up a garbage can and it'll look great till you pull the top off and it's rotten inside. Okay? Recovery's an inside job. It ain't got nothing to do with the outside. Because if you take away all that outside stuff, what are you left with? I never forgot that lesson. Recovery's about changing what's on the inside, not what's on the outside. Sometimes our outside needs to be better, so that we feel better about ourselves and become willing to do something about the insides. But if we never do anything about the insides, then the thing that's rotten in us stays in us. And it doesn't matter how well we dress it up, sooner or later, it will get hot enough so the top comes off. And what's rotten is what's going to be in front of us. Okay? And I mean, I've had that experience. I can tell you what it is to be 5 years clean, in a service meeting, pounding on tables, being vulgar, cussing people out in the name of NA service. And being right. Right? Being right. I can open the book up and show you I am right. There's no exclusivity on being an asshole in Narcotics Anonymous. There's no time limit. Okay? There's no number of meetings, service commitment. There's no thing that says, okay, once you get past this threshold, you no longer have the capacity to be completely stupid and ignorant in Narcotics Anonymous. Because I am living proof that you can do it for a long time in these rooms, even when you think you're right. In fact, the more right I thought, the more out of line I would act. Because after all, I'm right. One of the core tenets of this addict's belief is, I have no right to ever cause myself or anyone else harm. Basic recovery. Okay? So, if I cause harm, it doesn't matter what I caused harm over, I was wrong. See, you know, our program is simple but effective. Basic tenet. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on NA unity. What that means to me is that my opinion is second to our opinion. And that my recovery depends upon my ability to make my opinion second to our opinion. Now, the first tradition may mean something else to you. That's okay. But the addict that stands before you, that's part of what's at the bottom of that brick wall. That's what I believe. I believe that if I lack the capacity to be honest, open-minded, and willing, that wall collapses. I believe if I become unwilling to help another addict, that wall collapses. I believe if I ever stop being grateful for the gifts that I've been given in these rooms as a result of the principles of Narcotics Anonymous, that wall collapses. Because I ask myself all the time, how many meetings? How many service commitments? How many rides? How many H&I panels? How many convention commitments? How many speakings? How many books do I have to give the newcomers? How many convention registrations do I have to give away? How many of whatever it is that I do I have to do until I've done enough? Where is that tag? What is the price of the life I've been given. And you know what? I can't tell you what that is, because the addict stands before you today, don't believe he's paid it yet. And I've been here a long time, paying on account. So, you know, I've had sponsees ask me, well, you know, how long do I have to do this? Really? How long do you want to stay alive? How long, you know, at what point do you believe you've done enough to thank the God of your understanding for everything that you have in your life today? You tell me where that line is. I'm not going to argue with you. I'm not judging. I'm just asking, where is that point for you? Because I know for me, after 35 years, I haven't done it yet. So I don't know what that number is for you. You know, I've had all of these experiences. You know, the biggest thing for us, and if you're new, please, please, please hear me. Change is an evolutionary process that does not happen overnight, and you have to be willing to do the work necessary for change to occur, and if you are not, you will not change. Because as an old friend of mine named Doreen used to say, if nothing changes, nothing changes. And there's no time limit on when that stops being true. So we could stay here forever. We could stay clean forever. Don't mean we changed. Just means we didn't use. We went to meetings. We talked about the program in Narcotics Anonymous. You know, after a year, nowadays, 6 months, 3 months, this becomes an easy program to talk about. You can quote the literature. You can point to the pages. You can, you know, recite all of the sayings. You can sit in meetings and say all the right stuff and have people sitting there nodding right with you, you know, like, yeah, you're speaking the gospel. But you lack the capacity to walk out the room and do what it is that I stand here and talk about. So the basic recovery for this addict is, if I can't do it, I need to stop talking about it. Because doing it is what this is about. Talking about it's easy. I mean, most of us could talk our way out of just about anything. So, you know, that old saying, talk is cheap. Well, yeah, it is. It's the doing that's hard. You know, I learned how to tree box people when I came here. For those of you that ain't from the East Coast, see, y'all, you know, who live in the West enjoy a lot of trees. But those of us that live on the East Coast, trees are a scarcity in most urban environments. And so they're planted in these things called tree boxes. So on a block, you may have 4 or 5 trees planted on concrete. Tree boxing means you step back behind the tree and you watch somebody. That's what I learned how to do in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. Because it all sounded great. I started to watch. Listen to what you say. Watch what you do. And when the two things didn't go together, wrong guy. I'm looking at somebody else. Okay? Not that I had an expectation that any of us were going to be perfect, because I certainly wasn't. But I at least expected you to stand up and talk about imperfections and a desire to be better, because that's what I was taught, basic recovery. The desire to be a better person tomorrow than I was today. The desire to not get loaded no matter what. I am a proud, proud member of the Not Getting Loaded No Matter What Club. Okay? And I'll tell you something. You know, there have been things that have happened in my life over the course of the last 35 years where a shot of dope just for a fleeting moment seemed like, wow, that would be such a welcome relief. But I got to tell you, I've seen people who tried that course. You know, I ain't never been able to do one or nothing. Okay? Never. You know, I used to listen to this guy named Shorty. He was talking about his drug of choice, and people asked him what it was. It was more. It wasn't one more. It was just more. Because I don't know. I don't understand those limits. I don't understand how you take and have a pile of something and decide I'm only going to do a little bit. I don't understand how you have a box of Krispy Kreme donuts and decide to only eat one. I don't understand. I don't understand how you walk into a store and decide I'm going to buy one shirt when I got the money to buy 20 shirts. I don't understand. I don't understand how you... I don't understand how you watch a young lady walk past you in a pair of extremely tight blue jeans, and I'm married to a beautiful woman. She's sitting right there, and I will say, she knows full well I'm going to look. Okay? Because that's the nature of the addict that stands before you. I suffer from an incurable illness that is always, always trying to find where is the weakness? Where is that hole? Where is my opportunity? How can I get him today? Is he weak today? Is he practicing his program today? Are his principles at work today? Because the disease don't take a vacation. Now, I have. There have been periods that I have taken a vacation from the process. There have been periods where I have been satisfied with complacency. There have been periods where I believed I was insulated, protected from the disease I suffer from. And God, in my understanding, has allowed me to survive each one of those periods every time it's happened. I haven't had perfect vigilance to the principles of the steps. I haven't had perfection with honesty, perfection with willingness, perfection with open-mindedness. There are times where I've been judgmental. There are times where I've been motivated to be dishonest out of instinct. I didn't have to think about it. Just bam. Because that's the nature of the addict that stands before you. That's the reality of an incurable illness. That's what it means when it says it can, however, be arrested at some point and recovery is impossible. If you don't arrest it, recovery ain't possible. And if you let the disease loose, if I let the disease loose, watch out. Because putting it back in the box, I have no assurance of. And I'm going to tell you, there have been times here where I have kept the addict in the box, not because of the perfect application of principle, but because I was too afraid to let him out that I wouldn't be able to put him back in. That's the reality of the addict that stands before you. You know, I'd love to tell you that after 35 years and, you know, repeated surrenders and repeated acknowledgments of a higher power and repeated acceptance of being restored to sanity, repeated inventory, repeated, you know, trying to get rid of my defects, that all of that's worked and they're all gone and I'm great and, you know, here I am. You know, all that in a bag of chips. Don't believe it for a second. It ain't true. I'm just as susceptible today to walk out this room, walk across the street and buy a dozen Krispy Kreme donuts, run through the parking lot, eat all 12 of them, wipe my mouth, and walk back in the building like I ain't done nothing. Now, you know, I'm a diabetic. See, that's the nature of the illness that I suffer from. So what basic recovery is about isn't just about staying clean. It starts out about being clean. But it has to evolve to be about becoming a different person. It has to evolve as a result of these principles to making me something better than I was. Because otherwise, what's the point? I didn't come to Narcotics Anonymous to be miserable. I was miserable before I got here. I came to Narcotics Anonymous because you promised me a better way if I was willing to do what you do. I became willing to do what you did because I wanted what you had. Not your cars, your woman, your money, although that stuff was nice. I wanted that peace of mind that I see in the eyes of the addict that's practicing this program. And that's how you can tell. Just walk around and look in somebody's eyes. If you want to know what's really going on, you ain't got to say a word. Just walk up to an addict, look them in the eye. The truth is always evident. The truth is always staring you in the face. The truth is always going to be the message you see, not necessarily the one you hear. Because we are masters at trying to disguise the truth. You know, I talked about the fact that I'm married to a beautiful woman. I got to say something. You will hear people tell you that long-term relationships in Narcotics Anonymous are not possible because two broken people can't come together and create a broken relationship and devise anything that's healthy. That's a lie. That's a lie. You heard Jimmy talk about it last night. I have been blessed to have been with this woman, to have been married to this woman, for 36 years. We've been together, I don't know, 38, 39 years. And I'll tell you something. There have been days where I wanted to kill her. She wanted to kill me. There have been days where our sponsors mutually some days had to convince us that, hey, you know what? Give him one more chance. He deserves one more chance. Because there have been days where I have been such a raving lunatic that I would drive this woman out of my house. And there have been days where I've woken up and wondered, who in the hell am I next to? But hey, that's the reality of two people who are going through the process, evolving in principle at the same time. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be blissful every day. It just means that as long as, you know, I tell my sponsees this, here's the measure. If you are willing to accept that person as they really are, just for today, then maybe you're willing to do the work today to stay together. And the moment that that answer to that question becomes no, then you got a different choice to make. And I'm happy to say that after 36 years, the answer to that question has always remained yes. Sometimes more difficult than others, right, honey? But just for today, the answer to that question has been yes. You know, I've been blessed, man. I mean, I need to do this really quickly and shut up. If you listened to Jimmy last night, one of the things that you had to hear is the reality of life on life's terms. Okay? And I will tell you, especially for you youngsters, and I don't mean you no disrespect when I refer to you as being youngsters, but I'm 61 years old. I've earned the right to call a 30-year-old a youngster. Okay? You know, I mean you no disrespect, but I want you to hear this. When I was sitting where you were sitting 35 years ago, I never contemplated the reality that I might be alive 30 years from now. So I made decisions about how I live my life based upon the reality that I wasn't concerned about how I was going to live 30 years from now. But guess what? Here I am. Okay? And along the way, all them donuts and hamburgers and candy and soda and white bread and all this other crap is now taking its toll. Now I'm picking up the tab for all that bad living that I could have done something about 30 years ago. So, I realize that most of you young people don't want to hear what I'm getting ready to say. Okay? But, and we say just for today because that's what we're about. But every once in a blue moon, contemplate the possibility that 30 years from now, you will still be blessed to be in these rooms and still be clean, and you're going to have to live with the results of the decisions you make today. You might make different choices, because I stand before you. Diabetes, hepatitis C, I had, you know, end-stage renal failure, I had a kidney transplant a year ago. You know, I have every imaginable hypertension, and, you know, every imaginable thing that can happen to people, just about. I deal with it on a regular basis. But I need to talk once just about this transplant experience. You know, I talked about the fact that I didn't expect to live this long. And that was especially true when I first came into the rooms in Narcotics Anonymous. I just didn't believe that I would have to worry about being 60 years old. About 7 years ago, I mean, I've had all kinds of health stuff, but almost 8 years ago now, I was diagnosed with end-stage renal failure. And what that means is that my kidneys failed. And so to keep me alive, I had to walk into a place and they had to stick these two gigantic needles in my arm 3 times a week for 4 hours. And my life revolved around this treatment because it was about staying alive. So what happens when things don't necessarily go your way is, for me, for this addict, my faith started to be tested. I started to question the God of my understanding about why. why am I going through this? You know, what did I do? Tell me and I'll fix it. And then I realized that what it was really about was teaching me that faith was unconditional. Faith is about being absolute. Faith isn't about reservation. You know, faith is really easy when things are going your way. Right? But when they're not, faith is a whole different exercise. Because it means I have to believe that the God of my understanding has something in store for me better than what I have right now, and I can't see the outcome. See, we talk about it, our faith being unconditional. We talk about in the third step in particular, surrender my will and my life. Right? And, you know, I sit in meetings all the time. I've had meetings a thousand high surrender, and I'm willing to surrender, and yeah, God, come take my will and my life, until they start sticking their needle in my arm. And then it was like, well, I don't know that I want to give. I'm not sure. What's happening? And then it became clear to me. Think about how many others had died before they ever got the opportunity to get a needle stuck in their arm 3 times a week. Think about how many others never found out, never went to the doctor to discover what they were suffering from, and aren't sitting in these rooms no more. Think about the fact that you're still here. Why? Obviously because a power greater than you has a plan that you don't understand. And that's got to be okay. So I got up 3:30 a.m. every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I drove to the dialysis clinic. I got hooked up on the machine. I'd get straight off the machine, went straight to work. And, you know, I'm one of them guys that, you know, unfortunately, my wife don't like this sometimes, but I'm one of them guys that thinks of myself as a Viking. I can endure anything. Because you people and the God of my understanding has given me the strength to endure anything. That's life on life's terms. Life on life's terms ain't when it feels good. Life on life's terms is when you don't want to deal with whatever it is that's in front of you, but you ain't got no choice. That's the reality of what faith, living the program of faith, is about. That's what belief in a higher power, absolutely, without condition, without reservation, that's what it's about. It's in those times when we find out what we're made of, not the times where everything is okay. So I go through dialysis for 5 years. My daughter talked about giving me donating her organ, and that didn't work out. So I got to the point where I had resigned myself. My wife hates to hear me talk about this, but I resigned myself to checking out. I was okay with it being over. Because, after all, I had been here 35 more years than I was supposed to. I was supposed to have been dead in that car on 14th Street 35 years ago. So as far as I was concerned, I had been given a gift, a tremendous blessing, 35 additional years of life. And I had gotten really okay with checking out. And my wife looked at me and said, "You selfish bastard. How could you possibly be okay with that? How could you ever think to think that way is okay? How could that be consistent with the principles that you tell everybody else they're supposed to practice?" Then I started getting, you know, my overheard phone conversations back in my ear about everything I had ever said to a sponsee about living in faith and having principle and belief and, you know, okay. But I realized that my God put her in my life for that purpose, because it helped me to regain a desire to live. It helped me to understand that this was a gift, and that even though I was enduring all of this medical stuff, I'm still here. Being here is still a gift. If that's the price I had to pay to be able to be here, so be it. And it was at that moment that my faith once again became unconditional. It was at that moment that once again my gratitude spoke and became again a reality for me, that I was grateful for the gift that my God had given me, and that each day I was given was a blessing. And I still think of each day that I'm able to wake up and suit up, I'm blessed. Because I know it didn't have to be that way. Last March, a woman that I've known in this program for over 20 years decided that she was going to give me her kidney. And she called me and she said, are you willing to take my kidney if I give it to you? And I'm like, get the fuck out of here. And she said, no, I'm serious. If you will take it and they will let you have it, I will give it to you. Because I want to see the quality of your life improve. Now, how in the hell do you say thank you? How do you thank somebody for being willing to go lay on an operating table, have a part of their body cut out so that the quality of your life gets better? That's the miracle that happens in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous all the time. See, that's what the therapeutic value of one addict evolves to. It starts out with us helping each other to stay clean. It then evolves to us helping each other develop in a relationship with a power greater than ourselves. And then it evolves to us learning how to take this simple set of principles and make them an integral part of how we choose to live our life. And then it evolves to people who love us and care about us. And then it evolves to the place where people become willing to give of themselves to the extent humanly possible to improve the quality of our life. That's the miracle of what happens in these rooms. That's the reality of the evolution of one addict helping another. That's what this program is all about. That's what unconditional love becomes. All of that is in front of you. If you're new here, I promise you can achieve a life here beyond anything you can possibly imagine if you're just willing to do the basics. Don't use no matter what. Keep coming back. Try to be a better person tomorrow than I was today. Develop a belief in a power greater than ourselves, because it's that power that ultimately is going to save your life when you need it. And trust the members who are sitting beside you in these rooms, because the day is going to come where they're going to save your ass and you're going to need them too. Thank you for letting me share.